Okay, so we're going to turn in your Bibles to Philippians chapter 2. We're going to just continue on working through the letter here. And this section kind of ends the major portion of the letter that kind of deals with exhortation. So this is kind of where Paul wraps up some of the things that he's been driving towards. And it kind of helps us to understand, I think, in part, where Paul was going with the command that he gave us in 12 and 13, describing the saints' obedience and then commanding them to work out their salvation with fear and trembling. Now, they're doing so because God is at work in them. But what that looks like is basically described in verse 14. So that is kind of where he's going. And again, that the context tells us that what he's aiming for has more to do with the corporate relationships within the church than it does with you individually. And I think we understand that in part not just looking at the language of verse 12 and 13, but in looking at how he describes this command taking place, which is to not be whiners and arguers and disputers, all having to do with this inner conflict that's taking place within the church in Philippi. So let me just begin kind of giving you a little brief introduction, tying this back into where we were looking before. The previous section of Paul's letter focused on the obedience of the saints in Philippi. As you have always obeyed, so now, not only as in my presence, but also in my absence, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. So the aim then is not just building or grounding their present work off of their prior obedience, but their aim is to point us to the picture from the beginning, the first day that they came to know and hear the word of the gospel and know who Jesus is. That first day has been marked by obedience. And Paul is wanting them to continue their obedience, even in his absence, which is pretty remarkable. I think as parents, we wonder what will happen when we leave our kids home alone. What types of fights and quarrels will break out when the kids are on their own apart from any adult supervision? But here, Paul's confidence is that they would be even more obedient in his absence while he's away, 1,000 miles away in jail in Rome. He has great confidence, not necessarily that the saints in Philippi were such outstanding moral citizens, but that God was at work in them, right? To give them the will and the power to actually carry those desires out. So, Paul expected that they would continue to obey, to continue to work out their salvation, even in his absence, because God was working in them, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. So their working was the indicator that God was working. It's not, right? It's not that they were just passive and God was doing a bunch of stuff while they sat around and, you know, were amazed at what God was doing. And it's not as if they worked very, very hard because God wasn't working. It's that God worked in them and they worked out. They worked out their salvation. They worked out what God was working in. God gave them desires. He gave them not just, you know, you think about the radical change that takes place as a Christian. You want to do things that you never would even dreamed about doing before. That's because God gave you new desires. It's because God gave you a new heart. You think of wanting to live in unity and in harmony. That's because God gave you those desires. So God worked in them at the level of desire and then empowered them. He gave them the ability, he gave them the energy to carry those desires out. So in the passage we're looking at today, then Paul tells us precisely what it looks like for them to work out their salvation. What is he actually aiming at here? Not just a generic, you know, do all things for the glory of God, but he's looking at very something in particular. So this is the obedience that he is calling them to. This is the desire that he's presuming God is giving them, and this is what God is energizing them to carry out. So the passage really consists of only one command, one imperative, but it's absolutely loaded with allusions and echoes to the Old Testament scriptures. You think of in multiple places, Paul is drawing upon another story, perhaps the continuation of the same story in the way that he exhorts them now to be faithful and to work out their salvation. So he pulls these threads that are drawn from the story of rebellious Israel, which Deuteronomy 32 is just a part of. He pulls on these threads to show in the contrast them with what is taking place with the new community of God in Philippi. And then he wraps up this imperative, this command, and these descriptions by actually showing how closely intertwined his life is with theirs. There's this unique relationship taking place between Paul and this church in Philippi, that what one experiences, the other experiences. It's this weird dynamic that is going on, and that's how he kind of brings it to a conclusion at the end here. So with that, let me read through. I'm going to start actually in verse 12 and then read through verse 18. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only as in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain. Even if I am to be poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrificial offering of your faith, I am glad and rejoice with you all. Likewise, you also should be glad and rejoice with me. So the command Paul gives is found in verse 14. Do all things without grumbling or disputing. So after following a passage that describes their ongoing obedience, that describes God's work in them, that describes God's empowering of them, God giving them new desires, and then the great command to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. This command to do all things without grumbling and disputing comes as quite the surprise. I would think that there would be something a little bit more glorious following the great exhortation we see in 12 and 13. Right? This 12 and 13 come right on the heels of the great statement about Christ. Christ's own humility, his own humble mindset, which led him to come to earth and take take a human body and become a slave and become obedient to the point of death, to die a death on a cross even, and then to be exalted high above all. I understand how 12 and 13 follow on the heels of that, Christ's great descent and then ascent. But complaining, grumbling, arguing, it seems like he could have said there's something far more important for you to be concerned about than just complaining and grumbling and disputing. I think if we actually came up with a list of do's and don'ts, you know, we tried to summarize the great do's and don'ts of Scripture, I think complaining and arguing would probably be at the bottom of the list. I never read the book, but Jerry Bridges wrote a book called Respectable Sins. Sins that we tolerate in our lives, we make excuses for. We don't actually use the power of the Spirit and the sword-cutting nature of the Word to get them out of our lives. I think you know that these would probably be in that book. Respectable sins. Sins that don't really seem that bad. A little grumbling and complaining, isn't that just part of living in a fallen world? Isn't that just part of having, you know, a kind of messed up life and bad nature? I think these things probably come a little bit too natural to us. And he says to not do anything with grumbling and disputing. So we're going to dig into this and see how these are very easily overlooked in our lives when compared to more serious vices. So why does Paul put that emphasis upon them in this section? I think the grandeur of what has actually taken place in 12 and 13 helps us to see the surprising nature of the command in verse 14. We see then that obedience is not just their participation or their partnership with Paul in the gospel. Obedience is not just about how they support Paul in his ministry of spreading the gospel. It's not even about how they have shared in Paul's ministry in spreading the gospel. Yes, they supported him, even when other churches didn't. But their obedience didn't just stop there. It didn't just stop with their support or their partnership in the gospel. There was something far more ethical, I think, going on. Something far more moral going on. It's not just in how they responded to Paul, right? They weren't just obeying what Paul told them to do, but it is reflected in how they respond to each other. There was a particular relationship that had formed because God did something in Philippi, as he was doing in other cities across the Roman Empire. God brought these people together. He did something new. He gave them new life, and he formed this new fellowship, this new community in which they had to learn to live together. This was God's new family. They're now brothers and sisters, and they had to learn how to relate with one another. So their obedience then is directed towards Paul, yes, as the apostle of Christ, but their obedience is also directed towards one another. They understand that there are certain things they have to do now because God did a wonderful work in changing their lives. So Paul's prayer, remember, reflect back on Paul's prayer in Philippians 1, right? That their love would abound more and more with knowledge and all discernment, that they would approve what is excellent, and so be pure and blameless for the day of Christ, filled with the fruit of righteousness that comes through Jesus Christ to the glory and praise of God. That is the prayer that he offers up for them. And that has everything to do, not just for the individual, but everything to do for the community. So they are to grow and abound in their love for one another. They are to learn what it looks like to actually show that love in a practical way, to approve what is excellent. And they are to be filled with the fruit of righteousness. That's reflected in their relationships with each other. The focus is that they would be bound together for the gospel because they have been bound together by the gospel. That they would be striving side by side in unity, having the same humble mindset that looks out for others' interests as they consider others more important than themselves. So then the command to do all things without grumbling and disputing, it actually fits very nicely into the context of the letter as a whole. I think more than that, we see this command, the importance of it, in the description that follows verse 14. So if I were to ask you, what is it, or what would it be, what would cause us as a community to stand out unblemished in the dark and hostile generation, what would you say that one thing would be? I think we're being told, that we have been told for the last year, what that one thing would be. Conformity to the virtue signaling that's being taken place and is being forced, not forced, but very heavily recommended upon people. I think that is the particular ethical thing that we are now obligated to do as patriotic citizens, to get the jab. Now, that's the way that it's being presented. That's the way that's being presented to me at my job, at the Department of Homeland Security. That's the way that it is being portrayed in the media, that this is now your ethical, moral ought as a patriotic citizen. Now, I think there are other higher standards and the other ways in which we display the morality that God has actually described for us to do. We have to be very careful on what we say is our moral ought. And it can't come from any other source besides Scripture. So what we're doing here is we're understanding what God has actually called us to do, not what the president or the media or certain employers and bosses have called us to do. What does God call us to do? And what he says for the Philippians then is that in order for them to be blameless, innocent, and without fault in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, what they ought to do is not complain, not whine, not argue and dispute. So it does help us to understand how serious those things are. That is where Paul lands on the implications of whether or not they argue and complain and dispute, whether these grumblings are taking place, these whisperings and murmurings are taking place within the congregation. So, it does help us to understand and highlight the importance of this. We know that the church was experiencing some sort of conflict. We don't know exactly what that conflict was. That's why there's such a stress on unity. We do have a specific example that's given at the end of the letter where he calls on two people in particular to agree in the Lord, right? Philippians 4:2, I entreat Euodia and I entreat Syntyche to agree in the Lord. That word agree is the word that stresses the same thinking, the same mindset. It's what Paul is actually used to in calling the saints there to have the same mindset, have the mindset that's actually in Christ. They are to think the same way about whatever it is that's causing them to disagree. So we know that there's the stress, the need for unity for the sake of the gospel. We know that this unity is actually going to be what helps them protect themselves from the outsiders who are causing the suffering and persecution. And we know that the internal unity that this church has is what's going to prevent them from actually fracturing and dividing and losing their purpose, the purpose to which God has called them. So this rift has happened within the church. And then the grumblings and complainings kind of feed into that, right? So the reference, of course, is what we'll see is that this is a reference back to the grumblings of the Israelites in the wilderness. He's drawing upon that string. He's drawing upon that theme from the Israelites in the Old Testament. And the question then is, what is the grumbling and who's complaining about what? Or who's complaining about who? So we don't actually know. There could be grumblings from the congregation about their leadership. It could be grumblings in the congregation towards Paul. It could be grumblings in the congregation because of their suffering. Like we don't know exactly what's going on here. So we're left to kind of sort it out on ourselves, sort it out by ourselves. We do know that the sin of grumbling and the sin of disputing is something that cannot simply be overlooked, right? We can't just overlook this minor sin and focus on the bigger things that are affecting the body. Apparently, these are big enough to affect the unity of the church. I don't think it takes much of an imagination to see how that can actually happen, right? How easy is it for gossip to destroy the unity of a church, or for slander to destroy the unity of the church, or for whisperings to destroy the unity of a church? I think we could probably all think of examples in which that has taken place. So we see the importance of this command, this minor sin in the eyes of the world and in the eyes of most of the church has the ability to threaten the integrity of the church as a whole. It has the ability to jeopardize their identity as the children of God. And their response to Paul's command, it will determine what kind of children they will be. Are there going to be blameless, innocent, without fault children of God? Or are they going to be a corrupted church, just like the generation that they're living in? So let's look at these two words here for just a moment. What does Paul mean by grumbling and disputing? I think most translations will say something like this: grumbling and disputing, or complaining and arguing, or murmurings and disputing. And the first word used here is actually used in a couple other places in the New Testament. John 7:12, it describes the disagreements that arose among the crowds concerning Jesus' identity. So some say Jesus is this type of character, some say Jesus is this type of character, and a dispute, an argument broke out among the crowds because they were divided over who Jesus was. I think we also see this word used in Acts 6:1. And Acts 6:1 describes the complaint that the Hellenists had over their widows being neglected in the daily distribution. So that's what led the apostles to set apart men who were able to serve tables so they could devote themselves to prayer and the ministry of the word. Peter describes in 1 Peter 4:9 that hospitality is to be given without complaint. So that gives us a picture of the nature of hospitality within the New Testament. I know the women are doing a study through hospitality. I think that's about to be wrapped up in a couple weeks. But the hospitality that's offered is to be done without complaint, implying that there will be some sort of wrong that is done through the hospitality, or there's some sort of inconvenience that is done through the hospitality. Right? Do so with a nature, with a demeanor that doesn't actually whine about it or complain about it. So the word actually can mean then, it can hint at a subtle dissatisfaction with the way things are, or even a skeptical or speculative attitude towards something or someone. So some dictionaries highlight the secretive nature of this, and I think that's where we hear the word of whisperings, right? Some dictionaries talk about how the nature of a complaint or the murmuring is something that takes place in the corner, right? It's somebody hiding, whispering quietly, secretively about something. You think of the nature of a community, how that can easily disrupt what type of harmony or unity the community has. If somebody's off in the corner whispering something about someone else and that spreads to the congregation, then obviously we have a virus, we have a disease that needs to be dealt with. What is whispered in the corner doesn't stay there. So the seemingly small and insignificant dissatisfaction with what is taking place in the church can grow to undermine and destroy the community. So do all things without grumbling, murmuring, whispering. And again, the object of this word is hard to nail down. We know that this community was suffering, right? They're being persecuted because of their faith in Christ and for the sake of Christ. That's what he goes into, right? They're engaged in the same conflict that they saw that Paul had and now hear that he still has. So there is opposition from the outside. So this murmuring or this grumbling could be directed from the community to God. God, why are you letting this happen? This is not my plan, God. This is not good for what you're trying to do in the world. Which you could see Paul kind of offsetting that when he says that what has actually happened to me has turned out for the benefit of the gospel. The gospel has actually progressed because I'm in jail. It actually spread to the whole Praetorium Guard, right? It spread throughout Caesar's household. God is still at work in spite of my imprisonment, using my imprisonment to spread the gospel. So it could be directed towards God, and I think that would be the common ground that's found then in the experience of the Israelites when they were in the wilderness, because they complained about Moses and they complained to the Lord. Why did you bring us out here to die? I wish that you would have just left us in slavery, left us in bondage in Egypt. It would have been far better for us to just stay in bondage in Egypt instead of come out here and die. How could you? How could you redeem us and bring us out here to perish? So we don't really know, but we do have... Let me go through the second word here, the disputing, the arguing. Now, this word is actually used both in a positive and a negative sense in the New Testament. I think morally, arguing is not a sin. Obviously, he's describing something here that is disruptive and is divisive, and it has the potential to destroy this community, right? But engaging in arguments, and the word here is my guess is this is where we get the word dialogue from, something that's completely missing from our culture, the idea of a conversation about something. So the word is actually, the idea is a good thing, but obviously Paul is telling us to do everything without it. It's not, there's certainly a negative aspect of what's going on here. So negatively, the word is used to describe an intellectual rebellion against God. That's Romans 1. It's used to describe a judgment that is grounded in ungodly principles. That's James 2. It's used to describe a deliberate doubt or questioning of what is true in spite of the evidence provided. So we see this example happening in the end of Luke's gospel. Jesus actually calls the disciples to account for their doubts, right? Jesus appears to them as the resurrected Lord. He asks the disciples, why are you troubled and why do doubts arise in your hearts? So he's appearing before them And yet they're refusing to believe the evidence that is presented to them. They're doubting the validity of the resurrection because they didn't expect the resurrection to happen. That was his whole point, because from that point on, he began to teach them from the scriptures of what would happen to the Christ, what must happen to the Christ. So in a negative sense, then, the word means something like being argumentative, being divisive, doubting, or dissenting. And not necessarily necessarily to say that all doubting is wrong. Of course, I think there is a healthy skepticism that we should have. But in the context here, this is what is dividing the body up. First, the whisperings and the murmurings and the complaining. And then on the other hand, we have a dissenting spirit, and we have divisiveness, and we have doubt creeping in. There's something that is causing havoc within the congregation. So the call then, the positive aspect here, is it kind of an all-inclusive call for a same-mindedness that is grounded and shaped by the truth of the gospel, because God is at work in them and through them to a fallen world. So this does not only just affect a few things that we do from time to time, but it affects all things. Do all things without a spirit of murmuring. Do all things without a dissenting, argumentative spirit. So if you find that you're questioning everything that is done within the community, even, I think the implication is that this applies at more places than just the church, right? Paul is not saying you can, feel free when you gather on Sundays, the Lord's Day, you can come without complaining and arguing, and then when you go home, you can complain and argue all you want. No, he's not actually describing that. Obviously, the implication of this goes into all aspects of life. And I think it touches on one of the particular heart issues that we have. As I kind of mentioned, the idea of a respectable sin, a sin that we tolerate. We should be saturated with contentment in who God is and what he's done for us. Of course, there's a lot of other ways and directions this could go, but we have to understand, at least at its core, our contentment is grounded in what God has done for us. It's been saturated because God is at work in us, and he's at work through us to a fallen world. So everything they do together should be done not with secrecy or whisperings or argumentation or doubting spirits, but with openness and contentment and a unity that flows out of the gospel. So, that's verse 14. We're going to try to speed through this very congested next four verses. So Paul doesn't just give this command in a vacuum, right? This is not just like the first thing that comes to mind and says, okay, I think it's time that we address complaining and whispering and disputing. No, we've already remarked that he's addressing a very specific church with a very specific problem. It reminds me of what we see kind of in Revelation, in the letters to the churches in Revelation, right? And one of those churches he writes and he says, you guys have done a lot of good stuff, but one thing I have against you. I think that's what I see happening in Philippi. You guys have done a lot of good stuff. You've been really supportive of my ministry. You've been partners with me from day one. You've been obedient from day one, but I do have one thing against you. And it looks like this. There's selfishness in your midst. There's something that is going on that is actually threatening the unity of the church. And let me give you some examples and why. Let me give you some reasons why you can strive together, why you need to strive together for the faith of the gospel, why you need to not allow whatever is causing the division to actually have that effect. So he calls attention to their example. He calls attention to his example. He calls attention to Christ's example. In the next two sections, we see two more examples of guys, of faithful co-workers who are giving up their lives for the benefit of others. So all of it then combines to help us to see this is what Paul is calling them to do. The benefit of them actually doing everything without grumbling or complaining, without grumbling or disputing, is verse 15, that they would be blameless and innocent children of God without blemish. Interesting that he could put such an emphasis upon these two things, or not doing these two things, that the result would be that they would be blameless, that they would be innocent, that they would be without blemish, right? They would be a pure and spotless bride, if only they would avoid grumbling and complaining and disputing, right? That's the way that it reads. That's exactly what he's saying. And like I said, this doesn't mean that they were perfect outside of this. It just means that this was the major flaw that the church had. But notice their identity. So it's not that if they do this, they would become the children of God. Right? That's not what he's saying. He's describing who they already are. You already are the children of God. And if you avoid grumbling and disputing, then you will be blameless and innocent children of God. And that you would dwell blamelessly and innocently and without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation. Now, the uniqueness of what Paul is doing here is that he is alluding back to that Deuteronomy 32 passage, Deuteronomy 32 verse 5. That's what he's doing. He's alluding back to the grumbling generation. Exodus 16 and Numbers 14 and Numbers 17. Numbers 14, they grumbled against the Lord. Remember that this is the sin that prevented them from entering the promised land. They grumbled against the Lord. They complained against the Lord. It was a sin that kept them out of the promised land. The sin that caused God's judgment to fall upon them in the wilderness. The sin that brought about the destruction of an entire generation. So when we think about complaining and disputing and arguing, whether that's directed to each other or directed to leadership or directed to God, this is no small sin. That's why Paul gives such weight to the command. So it's by their obedience that to this that they would be blameless and innocent, without blemish. All three of these words highlight the purity of the church. Get one of these things out. Get this stuff out and you guys will be pure and blameless. I think reading Deuteronomy 32:5, this is what he says. Describing the Israelites, they have dealt corruptly with him of the Lord. They are no longer his children because they are blemished. They are a crooked and twisted generation. Interesting, huh? So he describes them as, you know, as a bunch of grumblers and complainers and whiners. As a bunch of people that have corrupted themselves. They are no longer his children. They have corrupted themselves. They are blemished. So they have fault. And they are a crooked and twisted generation. So then what is Paul doing by alluding to this passage? I mean, almost quoting it verbatim, right? He's drawing a contrast between the saints in Philippi and the Israelites, the rebellious Israelites. I think there's probably more going on than this, though. But we recognized last week that God is doing something in the hearts of the people in Philippi, right? And that marks the beginning of something new. That marks the beginning of the new covenant, where God's promises to not just address people on the exterior, but to put his law within their hearts and in their minds, and to put his spirit within them, to cause them to walk in a way of obedience, actually marks the beginning of the new covenant people of God. So when he identifies them as the children of God, this is not the stepchildren of God, but this is the children of God who actually received the fulfillment of the promises. This is the children of God who really have been cleansed and who really have been purified, who really have been the blemishes removed. And the contrast then is between this new covenant people of God with the rebellious, disobedient, grumbling old covenant people of God. It's almost as if he's drawing this distinction intentionally to show not just the privilege the saints in Philippi have as the new covenant people of God, but to show their relationship to the old. In the old, even though Moses holds out to them the the words of life, right? That's what he says at the end of his song. Here it is. Here's the words of life for you. This is either going to be an easy word for you if you obey it and keep it, and God is going to bless you and keep you, or it's going to be a hard and challenging, difficult word for you. It will end up not being an actual word of life, but it will actually end up being a word that brings condemnation. It will be a ministry of death, as Paul says in 2 Corinthians. So the contrast is given then. A beautiful twist, if you will, of what we see happening in Deuteronomy 32 and what we see happening in the New Testament. The saints who don't grumble, who don't complain, who don't argue, actually stand out as the children of God, as blameless children towards a crooked and twisted generation. Same word that Paul uses, or same word that's used in Deuteronomy 32, the same phrase that Jesus uses in Matthew 17, the same phrase that Peter uses in Acts chapter 2. Crooked generation. I think a really beautiful picture. And that doesn't just end there, because he kind of keeps going. He keeps rambling a little bit. Then he describes there another twist, he describes how they actually appear to this crooked and twisted generation. So not only are they blameless and innocent and without blemish, they are lights. They shine bright as lights in the world. Among whom you shine as lights in the world. Obviously, probably picking up on a little bit of what Jesus says when he calls his followers, his disciples, the light of the world. Let your light shine before men. But I think even more clearly, picking up on what Daniel says in Daniel chapter 12, where Daniel says this: "At that time shall arise Michael, the great prince, who has charge over your people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never has been since there was a nation till that time. But at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone whose name shall be found written in the book, and many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt." And this is it, Daniel 12:3. "And those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the sky above, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever." I think Paul is alluding to that verse. They are like the stars that shine bright in the heavens. They shine as lights in the world to a crooked and twisted generation. I think, obviously, this is describing who they are. Again, emphasizing the fact that they already are children of God. Describing, in fact, I think, that they already are lights in the world. The privilege of the saints as they strive to work out their salvation with fear and trembling, as they work without grumbling and complaining and are blameless and innocent, that they are bright, shining stars to a generation that's shrouded in darkness. I think the powerful, not just the powerful testimony of a unified group of people, as powerful as that can be, as needed as that can be, this is something more going on here. God is actually working through them to reach a dark world. You know, some people see kind of a hint at evangelism in this, the purpose of a light shining in a dark world. Even going on to describe in verse 16, holding fast to the word of life. Some people view that as them holding forth the word of life. They're offering up the gospel to those in the darkness. I think that might be reading a little bit too much into it. But it's important to note that there is probably that dynamic going on, because Paul could never separate his ministry from what God was actually doing through him to reach the Gentiles, right? Even in jail, when you would think that the opportunities to preach the gospel would be severely limited, that's precisely what he did. So even here, this community that is being threatened from without and being challenged by what's going on within, they're still there as a bright, shining light to a dark world. They do so by holding fast to the word of life. Perhaps one of the most beautiful descriptions of the gospel that we see in all the writings of Paul. Not just the word that promises life. You know, we could say that the words in Deuteronomy 32 promise life to the one who was able to keep it. But here, this is the word that actually brings life. This is the word that actually gives life. Obviously pointing to the life of Christ, his eternal life and his resurrection life. But pointing to the word that actually accomplishes that life in a group of people. This is the word that is not just characterized by life, but a word that actually brings life to a people that are dead in their trespasses and sins. And this is the word that the saints in Philippi are clinging to, right? They are not wavering from this word. This is the same language that Paul, whoever wrote Hebrews, used in Hebrews 2, where it talked about how we should not neglect this word that has been given to us. We must remain devoted and focused on it unless we drift away. We slowly turn away from the truth and we waver and follow something else. So here the picture is them holding fast to clinging to the word of life, keeping a firm grip on it, being fully devoted and dedicated to it. This, along with them avoiding the sins of complaining and disputing, will allow them to be a blameless and innocent, without blemish group of people, children of God, in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation. Now I think when we wrap this up quickly, we see Paul now drawing the connection between his experiences and theirs. And it's an amazing way in how he does that, because he holds the obedience of the saints in Philippi, he holds that obedience up, and he says basically that as you obey this command that I've given you, as you work out your salvation with fear and trembling, that will be my ground for boasting in the day of Christ Jesus. So again, connecting the two together. What the saints are doing in Philippi has everything to do with Paul, with his role as an apostle. Right? He's called to be an apostle to the Gentiles, to bring about the obedience of the faith of the Gentiles. So his responsibility then as an apostle is tied to what they do. How can Paul have confidence in what the will of someone else does? Right? How can his confidence lie? How can his boasting lie in the obedience of a group of people that live thousands of miles from him? Because he knows that God is working in them to will and to do according to his good pleasure. He knows, I think, he knows uniquely that the Spirit of God is actually using the letters that he's writing, whether he knew it at the time or not. The Spirit is inspiring his words to accomplish his purposes in a group of people. So Paul then holds them up. By their obedience, that in the day of Christ, I'm going to boast. I'm going to glory. ESV says, I'm going to be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain. Using those two ideas, those two metaphors of his ministry. Running, like an athlete that competes in the game, in the games, and laboring, like the tent maker that he was. Running and laboring, describing his ministry, that his running and his laboring would not be in vain, because he knows that God is accomplishing his purposes. That he would be proud in the day of Christ, that he would gladly boast in what God is doing in the Philippians, really not in what Paul is accomplishing himself, but in what God is doing in the Philippians, in their obedience and working out their salvation. And then he does something unique in 17 and 18. So he describes his life, or perhaps his death, as kind of a sacrificial offering. He describes the role that the Philippians are having as a sacrificial offering, right? It's kind of convoluted to describe what's the relationship going on here. Paul says, I'm a drink offering that's being poured out upon the sacrifice and service of your faith. So ESV says a sacrificial offering, but it's actually two separate words. It's the sacrifice and the service of your faith. And you're left with, okay, what picture is Paul actually giving us here? So he's describing, I think, the role that he has in complementing their sacrifice and their service. So it's unique that Paul actually calls attention to their service, not only at the end of this chapter, but at the end of the letter. So in Philippians 4:18, he says, "I receive full payment and more, I am well supplied, having received from Epaphroditus the gifts you sent, a fragrant offering, a sacrifice acceptable and pleasing to God." So speaking there of their financial contributions or financial support of his ministry and of him as a fragrant offering, a sacrifice that is pleasing to God. Here, Paul compliments their sacrifice by describing himself, metaphorically of course, as a drink offering. So if the picture is of the saints in Philippi offering up a sacrifice, or perhaps even being a sacrifice themselves, then what Paul is doing is that he's pouring himself out alongside them to complement the sacrifice. So obviously the picture here is of the Levitical ceremonial system in which sacrifices were offered, whether that be a meat sacrifice or a grain offering. And then in conjunction with those offerings, what was poured out was a glass of wine. So as the grain offering is being offered up on the altar, the glass of wine is poured out on it or next to it or something like that. So then Paul describes his life, perhaps anticipating his death, perhaps just describing the nature of his ministry as a pouring out of a drink offering. So his life is then depicted through this metaphor that he is offering up himself as a sacrificial offering, as a drink offering that complements the offering of the saints in Philippi. Even if that is taking place, or even if that will take place through his death, he is glad and rejoices with you all. Likewise, you also should be glad and rejoice with me. Notice then the tone that is cast over the entire passage. Not just the previous few verses, but from really the beginning of the book. That this tone of joy, this glorious emphasis upon rejoicing. Literally, he says, "I rejoice and rejoice with you all. Likewise, you also should rejoice and rejoice with me." I mean, four times in like one and a half sentences, he concludes this whole passage with joy. So in the midst of describing complaining and whining and arguing and disputing, in the midst of describing working out your salvation with fear and trembling, he concludes in the midst of describing offerings and sacrifices and being poured out, he concludes on the note of joy. We really shouldn't expect anything less, because from the beginning of the letter, this is what he's been driving towards, right? "Every mention of you in my prayers, I pray for you with joy. I rejoice because God is using my imprisonment for the progress of the gospel. I rejoice because Christ is being proclaimed. I want to be released from prison because I know that if I remain, it will be for your progress and joy in the faith." And then in the powerful exhortation he gives them in chapter 2, verse 2, right? "Complete my joy. Bring my joy to completion by your obedience, by humbly looking out for others' interests more than your own." So we see all of this then, that this joy that Paul experiences is not just his alone. It's something that he shares with the saints. And it's not something that is dependent upon the circumstances, right? Because he's in jail and there's conflict within the church. But it's something that he can conclude on, because he knows that by pouring out their lives, by offering up their lives as sacrifices, as drink offerings, that God is working in them both to will and to do for his good pleasure. I think that's why we can actually have confidence, and why joy is so essential in times of difficulty. I think that would be the time when joy would be absent, right? But that is why it needs to be all the more present. Because that is what actually is going to sustain us and allow us to be happy drink offerings, sacrificial offerings. We can gladly work out our salvation. We can gladly strive in the trenches, as we as we sort through the complaints and the whinings and the whisperings and deal with those tough sins that so easily take up residence in our hearts. Because we know that God started a good work. We know that God is working in the present to cause us to will and to do according to His good pleasure, and that He will be proud that our labor is not in vain. So with that, let me conclude by praying, and then we'll partake of the Lord's table together.